the addiction of wanting to be stirred up. And that is the opposite of what the typical aspect of meditation is. And I often consider what makes it so difficult for us to simply be present in the present moment. What are the conditions that we experience? Well, the mind stops. At least it has moments of being stopped. The body gets a chance to relax a little more, because the mind and the body have a very intimate relationship. Any discomforts or agitations in the body create agitations in the mind. The mind starts moving. It's like a little fire engine. It says, there's a fire going on. We've got to go and rescue. We've got to go and save. The problem is that the mind doesn't have the tools to quench the fire. So it fails. And in the failure, it creates more agitation in the body, which reciprocally, whatever the word is, creates agitation in the mind. And that's what's known as the vicious cycle, that we're continually experiencing, but that we only get to meet when we are still and quiet. The rest of the time, we're very happily distracted from this circle of mutual agitation, mutual stirring upness. So I've been asking myself, why are we addicted to being stirred up? What is it that keeps us from being able to stretch out and relax in the present, as if the present moment is a hammock that we can just rest in? And in fact, what is it that makes us resistant to being relaxed? When I think of what the conditions are that we want and what the world wants to tell us that we need, is more relaxation. When relaxation is just the natural state, in fact, neurologists have confirmed Tibetan Buddhist theory that the default state of the mind is being relaxed and mellow. A kind of state of well-being. Not as edgy as happiness, but well-being. I know that there are times when each of us in our meditation practice reach a state where things are just kind of humming along. The mind is quieted down, the body feels at ease, and we're simply floating in a very, very delicious space of attention. Just bare attention. Hardly any content, but the experience of being embodied. And then something happens and we move into a thought, a feeling, a memory, a concern, a worry. Oh, it's something to think about. Something to be agitated about. Something I may have forgotten. Something I'm not sure I'll be effective at in the future. So if we take away the past, we take away the future, we're just here in this present moment. Why isn't this enough? How come we're always striving for more? And just the sweetness of this present moment. Even here, in this room, now, there's a part of me that is always looking for the next thing to say. are listen for the next thing to hear. So we're in this collusion here. Of creating agitation, creating some sense of the granularity of experience. We're hungry for it. We want more. And if there's too much silence, we can always turn on the TV. There's an essential discomfort, an essential ill at easeness that happens when we hear our own inner mosquito. Reminds me of something that a client told me last week. She's not a practitioner, but we've been working on her addiction to food, trying to get her to experience the addiction without reacting to it or going to the fridge. What are the sensations in the body? What is she telling herself in her mind? And we've been working on it for some time. So last week she came in for her therapy session and she said, I had an amazing experience this week. I was curious, yes, tell me, let me know. She went to lunch, she's a woman in her mid-70s. She went to lunch with her friends. Now what can be agitating about a bunch of older women getting together for lunch? And she came home and she felt very, very nervy, kind of uncomfortable, ill at ease, and didn't know why. And she decided to do what we had been talking about for a long time, to sit down and feel the agitation and the restlessness in her mind and in her body before going to the fridge. And she put on her little egg timer for 20 minutes, committed to paying attention to herself. In a kind of naked, raw way, without being distracted, without following her inclinations, being intimate with what was immediately presenting itself in her mind and in her body, without interpreting it, without looking for narrative, just being present with the sensations. And she was committed enough that after a brief time, the sensations shifted and changed. And what do you think she was left with? Surprisingly to her, she was left with a feeling of joy. And she was so joyous that she decided to open her eyes and see how long it took for her to clean herself out and reach that state. 18 minutes. So 2 minutes less than 20 minutes got her into that place. And it was stunning to her to just see a state dissolve under the attention of awareness and leave a sense of joy permeating through. The contrast was such a gift to her that it made her a true believer. So I said, that's a wonderful, wonderful experience, but don't expect it to happen every time you sit. So if we commit ourselves to being that passionate in the core Buddhist principle, which has been true through all the different traditions and into the Vedic system, which is 6,000 years old, what is it that they are trying to do? They're trying to explore the nature of this experience. That's the fascination. It's a passionate commitment to knowing this thing we call the self. There's no faith required. There's no religious stories. There's a little bit of a directive about how to behave in the world, to be a good citizen, to not cause harm. But the simple, fundamental truth is to explore and discover the nature of this experience of self, being in a state we call being alive. Simple and profound as that. It's a fierce investigation. And I have absolute respect for all of us in this room tonight for the commitment to take on that ferocity, because it's not easy. It's not easy to uncover all the factors that create disruption in our moment-to-moment experience. Some of them are painful. I have a leg injury. I tolerated the pain for a while, and then I said, okay, I know the feeling. I'm going to release my leg and let it stretch out a little bit. But to be able to investigate what makes us ill at ease, what are the factors that keep us from just being comfortable? Just being comfortable. Not having anything to do, not having anyone to be, moment to moment, just being. The essence, the core of being, strips us of our individuality, of the identity, the striving, the becoming. And it's very, very threatening to what we call the ego, which I think is simply the battery that we call striving, the energizing battery, the bunny that never stops, awake or asleep. It's almost as if we avoid it because it feels like extinction. And on some level, it is a kind of extinction. It's extinction of our compulsivities. For that moment, they all stop, maybe. In any case, we can feel them pulling at us like very powerful magnets, things we would rather be doing. So if being in the present moment is the essence of being relaxed, not being pulled in one direction or another, then why is it something we resist? Resisting the fullness of our being. And the truth that we can uncover, the core seed of truth, is that our being is essentially a vibratory field that we call awareness, that gets cluttered up with stuff. And we sweep it clean when we meditate and we live in an empty room. No furniture. No media. Just bathing in emptiness for a the Buddhist path. Being able to sustain it, sustain longer and longer, and become very, very intimately and specifically aware of those things that keep us from it. Not hanging on to them, not judging them, just experiencing them neutrally, because everybody in this room, including myself, fundamentally have the same sets of experiences as distractions from the emptiness that communicates that we are all the same. We're all interconnected. We're all made of the same stuff. Our experience from one person to another is not that different. Maybe the quality or the color of our distractions are a little varied. But fundamentally, we're all trying to cope when really life is very easeful. In its essence, life is simply being present. So even now, as we're sitting here in this present moment, when silence happens, there's this slight bit of discomfort. Oh, I should say something. Oh, you want to hear something. Oh, there's something going on outside the window. Thank God. And the silence has not begun. Emergencies are going on. Urgencies are happening. And in a way, from moment to moment, we live from urgency to urgency. Even the first thing that we experience when we wake up in the morning very often is, what time is it? Am I late? What am I going to wear? Who am I going to meet for breakfast? How am I going to get to work? What do I need to bring along? What have I forgotten? It starts pouring out, concern after concern after concern, and the stress begins to build the moment we wake up in the morning. So this actually brings us here into this room because fundamentally we want a different way of living. And that was the passion of this gentleman that we call the Buddha. The passion was to teach the possibility that it is available to us to live differently. We don't have to always be in this continual agitated state, avoiding, striving, avoiding, striving. This Buddha was so convinced that it was possible. Why? Because he himself had experienced that release. And he was not very different from everybody else. Not the people that were around in his time, not the people before his time, and certainly not us, who are 2,500 years after his time. It's a constant principle of humanity to be in a disruptive, ill-at-ease state. The other day I was listening to NPR, and a woman who teaches at Harvard teaches the independence, the what of independence? It was 4th of July, right? The Declaration of Independence, thank you, two pages. How many here in this room have ever even read the So it was an interesting study, and part of what it expresses, of course, is that we all have the right to pursue happiness. And within the declaration, the fundamental support for the pursuit of happiness was a sense of equality. So from our practice position, we could say, since we're all equal, we're fundamentally all principally the same. We might look a little different, we might sound a little different, we might live in different houses and drive different cars, but fundamentally, we're all dealing with the same system. A set of neurological, physical, energized bodies with five senses in the mind, in this place we call a world where we interact. And when we realize that more and more and more deeply, we have less and less fear about being accepted, being okay, being enough. We can drop into this place called radical self-acceptance. We don't have to make our mark. We don't have to be unique. We don't have to achieve. It's okay and enough to just be. And in that being, we are in fact pursuing happiness, or at least a deep sense of relaxed well-being. We can forget about the comparison, the competition, the clawing for position. So I welcome the conversation between us tonight, what you bring into the room, or your responses, or any questions that you have about actual practice. Well, we can just be agitated mind, oh my God, oh my God. Oh my God, oh my God, is it me? Am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to show my ignorance if I ask a silly question or make a silly comment? Who cares? Yeah.
I find that when I finally come to a state of relaxation, I will drift asleep. So do you have any suggestions for that?
Wow, I wish I heard what you said. Just say it one more time, please.
I find that when I finally achieve a state of relaxation and quiet in the mind, then I start falling asleep. So do you
yes.
have a suggestion for that?
Yes, that's so, yes. So I do notice sometimes we nod off. And sometimes we nod off because all this agitation is fundamentally it's exhausting, mm-hmm. you know? And so the first response is to just go, oh, thank God, you know. The other one is that we don't have our sensory system equipped to see more subtle layers of things, you know. And so when the rough waves stop, then we feel like, oh, there's no ocean. So we'll just go to sleep. So a lot of what happens with practice is that we allow ourselves to become more sensitive. Our senses become more sensitive. I liken it to being in a room that was lit and the lights go off. It takes a little moment for our eyes to be able to see the shapes in a darkened room. So when the tall waves of experience settle out, our system, our whole internal mechanism says, oh, there's nothing to pay attention to, might as well check out. But But there's lots to pay attention to. And so, one of the techniques is to notice when you're going to sleep and say, okay, where is your body? What is happening with your posture? Because a lot of times we're folding over. So just become a little more erect, but not rigid. And commit yourself as it goes up and down. And every little element of the in-breath and the space in between, and then the full out-breath and the space in between that. And that will get you committed to keeping light on the senses. Because I think of sleep as turning the lights out on our sensory, our external sensory system. And, yeah?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You can open your eyes a little bit. And you can stand up. Standing up for long periods of time is a little trickier, you know? But you can definitely open your eyes. You're going to find some, you know, if you meditate with your eyes slightly open, something psychedelic begins to happen with your visual field. So that's always exciting. Yeah.
Suggestions for the mind's tendency to go into negative self-talk?
Yeah, well, you know, noticing that that's a tendency in your mind is the insight.
And the suffering that comes with it.
Yeah. And, you know, beginning to investigate where that negative self-talk arises from. You know, it's got a history. It was put in someplace. Doesn't mean that you need to, you know, go to battle with the people that gave you this negative self-image. I'm sure that you've been in battle with them for a while. And, you know, you can drop the battle and just notice the effect that the world has had on you. Self-compassion helps. That when you notice the suffering that arises from it, it's like, oh, this is harsh. Poor me. You can even call your name in a loving way. You know. But the insight is seeing what the content of your subjective experience is from moment to moment. Not wanting to change it. The perception is the thin edge of the wedge of change. Because wanting to change it, you begin to create a backlash effect. You know, our neurology is very delicate. And any little thought, any little impulse creates a tsunami wave of response energetically. So the fact that you have seen what you have seen is your wisdom about how you're connected. Congratulations. That's the insight. Yeah.
I guess piggybacking off of that, like, I've been surprised at how aggressive and just how forward, like, how you reach the places of relaxation or, you know, in longer periods of time over months when I feel like I'm getting into a better place of stretching that kind of, like you were saying. Just how strong the reaction is of saying the striving self or ego, whatever you want to call it. I can't believe how threatened it is from that. And I just, it's like hurt me sometimes. Because then I kind of recoil from a point of progression and then that kind of feeling like I have to take care of that part again. So I feel like I'm getting to a point where I'm going to break past that as a sense of the wisdom, but it's a bit frustrating to feel like have such a strong feeling of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, but being able to view that, what you just described, is a sign of your insight, you know? Because that's going on all the time, and most people don't even know that that's happening. So the frustration is an interpretation. It's your own judgment overlaying your direct view. So just notice, I from that experience. All of us do it. You know, the street talk is the ego. The ego says, hell no, I won't go. You know? But for me, I feel it's fear of extinction. It's just a profound gut response to emptiness. But emptiness is not a dry, hollow state. Emptiness is very juicy. Everything can arise out of emptiness. I like to say emptiness is the great pregnancy. So if we remember that, we can actually invite ourselves into that space and be a little forgetful of ourselves. I think that we're terrified that if we're forgetful of ourselves, we'll be attacked. Yeah. So that's the siren sound that comes on. Oh, quick, put it all back together again. That's not enough. I want to do more. You want to do more than just
the magic bullet.
The magic bullet. Magic is a good side. The bullet is your violence. Yeah, I know. So, you know, as you become more spacious in your practice, and this stuff begins to arise in it, and you realize that it's something that's been conditioned in the society that we live in, then you know it's impersonal. It's not you. It's not you. It's just moving through you. And if you judge it, you're going to close the windows and doors for it to continue moving through. So what you want to pay attention to is not the content of the violence, but your reaction to it. As if, ooh, this isn't who I am. This isn't what I want to experience, and this isn't supposed to be meditation. So it's our response to the experiences that we have that trap them in our backyard. You know, we really all want to be virtuous, and we all want to practice meditation as a spiritual practice, and we identify spiritual stuff as good, nonviolent, you know, loving kindness. And in a way, those are fruits of the practice. But they're not nothing, absolutely nothing is consistent. So we can arrive at the fruits of the practice and experience deep loving kindness. And then the next moment we want to kill someone. This is what happens. So, you know, to step back and laugh about it. If, you know, if we're not too identified and not too judgmental, it is truly hilarious, the things that reality concocts for the awareness to experience. So you might get to a place where you laugh about it. Yeah. Is that okay? Because of her. I heard that. We all heard that, Andy. Permission to do that, because I'm hearing that the example, right? Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, it was caused by a goat. My goat butted me, but actually it's probably getting older. You know, but I think that the thing of not moving and making a decision about something that disrupts us, I think that we have a tendency to do the same thing that we do with everything. It becomes this obsession. And so that's the thing to know, is how easily we fall into obsession when we want to do the right thing and be good. Good meditator, all of the rules. And the stricture behind that demand creates a lot of obsessive compulsive disorders that can lead to violence, because there's other people who don't follow the strict rules and they're bad, right? So I think giving yourself permission, Howie talks about being in a 3-month retreat in India, and he was struggling with a lot of pain in his knee, but he would not move. He was in, you know, the military meditation style. And to this day, his knee bothers him because he created an injury. So, yes. Right, there's always something. There's always something, that's true. And a lot of times when we move our bodies to become more comfortable, it only takes a matter of time until we realize that position doesn't work either. And so then we're back in. So the body is a receptacle for everything that our minds and our emotions generate. And the thing to do is to be compassionate with it. I know back east, you know, 3-month retreats in Great Barrington, Massachusetts in the summer, there's something called little black flies. And they will come in even through the screens when everybody is meditating. It's hot, it's close, it's sultry, and all of a sudden there's a little attack of little black flies biting into your flesh. What to do? Or just feel it, feel it, feel it. No, there's going to be itching after this. What do I prefer? Is this worse than the itching? And on the mind goes, right? Given half a chance, the mind will create volumes and volumes of reflection on something as simple as a little insect bite on the skin. But when we meditate and we cultivate silence inside, it creates a larger auditorium for the mind to perform in. That's one of the reasons that we like being distracted. You know, the mind becomes more shallow. So that's one of the things to appreciate. As we create inner silence and inner spaciousness, things that come up really resonate. Right? It's like echo chambers of thoughts. So after you see that insight, then you have the freedom to move your hair. I give you permission. I'm not the Pope, but I'm allowed to give you permission for whatever that, yeah. But it's you know, some people say, I was okay until I started meditating and now everything disturbs me. Because we have a bigger auditorium. And we're subtilizing our sensory system. So we want to, Suzuki Roshi said, well, the mind is like a cow, it wants to graze, just give it a bigger and bigger pasture. I say the mind is like a performing artist, it wants a bigger and bigger stage. And what it will do is demonstrate its attributes to you, which is something worth getting intimate with, because they're going on anyhow. They're going on underneath our conscious attention. Yeah.
You started out your talk by talking about how the outer realm and the inner realm, there's, you know, what's the difference, but I sometimes feel like it's projection, and that when you do meditation, it's similar to what you have on the outside, that just when you get stillness, there's this, oh, you think you got it? and life is kind of like that, where it continually keeps bringing up the same life lessons until you learn them. And so just when you think you get it, it twists it a little bit, and then you're like, oh, you think, you sure you have it? And so when I start to bring in my practice into beyond meditation and just be present in a walk with my dog, or be present at work, or be present in a conversation, I start to notice more life lessons and how they interconnect, and that does tend to be in parallel with what's disruptive in my meditation. So it starts to kind of flow a little bit more. I don't know if I'm really articulating that correctly.
Well, that's true. I mean, the whole idea is to take this, some aspect of this, into the rest of life. We don't want to create the spiritual side and the profane side, right? Because they're kind of the same. But we just bring a different attitude, a different level of awareness to our day-to-day experience. And it provides the spaciousness to reinterpret what's going on. Sometimes in a more subtle way, gentler way, there's more insight, there's more patience, there's more equanimity. All the fruits of the practice show up, whether you're walking your dog or having a fight with your boss, right?
Well, I'm self-employed, so yes.
That's self-employed. Fighting yourself. That's right. That's right. That's right. But ideally, that is what we want to do. We want to stretch the experience of being in position to being in the world, the so-called world. I don't know what you mean by projection.
And sometimes I see that there's a parallel to what is my test. Like, if I feel frustration, I can always tell when I feel frustration, it's in the same spot in my left shoulder all the time.
Oh, that's forward. Okay.
Yeah. I do this thing where I ask my body, what is it? And then after a few meditations, it'll sometimes come up. Mm-hmm. Or be like, oh, that's self-judging or self-hatred or... And so, but I do notice that those things tend to come up in a projection of life, where there's a mirror there that I can see life lessons showing me, oh, you're judging yourself, you're not supposed to be perfect, so you're making more mistakes, or you're finding more mistakes, but maybe you made them all along, but now you're just finding a bunch, like five in a row, you know, so you just...
We're so complex.
Yeah.
And we're hard on ourselves.
Right.
Sounds like you're... We're hard on ourselves, and we're always talking. There's always some conversation going on. So when we notice the conversation, instead of trying to find the solution at the end of the conversation, we might just cut the conversation and say, ah, I'm obsessing. This is a great moment for silence. Right? Because, like I said, the mind is like a little fire engine. If it feels discomfort, it's going to rush out, blow the sirens, and try to make it all go away. But in fact, it makes it more complex. It makes it more present, more confused. So sometimes if we find ourselves in that obsessive inner dialogue, that's like, okay, stop. The mind has a lot of capacity to solve problems, but it doesn't have the capacity to solve its own generated problems. So the mind needs a little more modesty. And it's 9:00. So let's just take a few minutes. And let's consider the intricate, complex processes, trillions of them going on right now in this moment. and the hum of all of that just generates infinite space. We take in a breath knowing that there's all the air that we need. So when we breathe out, we let go willingly. Nothing to hold on to. Remembering the letting go is as important as the breathing in.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.